You are listening to Shades of Freedom. Our second episode, special guest is Dwayne Betts.
Nobody says this when we talk about mass incarceration. You could do 10, 15, 20 years in a prison cell and don't see flowers, don't see any trees, and literally never see more than 10 books at one time. You know, I can't fix the flowers, I can't fix the trees. But you think about it, you know, you could have books that have all of those things in it.
Welcome to Shades of Freedom, a new podcast from the Aspen Criminal Justice Reform Initiative. We are pleased to have as our guest today, Dwayne Betts. Dwayne's story is one of tribulation and triumph. At 16, he was tried as an adult and spent 8 years in prison. He discovered a love for literature while incarcerated and decided to become a writer. Since his release in 2005, Dwayne has published 3 books of poetry and 1 memoir, received accolades and fellowships, including an NAACP Image Award, a Guggenheim Fellowship, and was appointed to the Coordinating Council on Juvenile Justice and Delinquency Prevention by President Obama, as well as receiving a law degree from Yale. Currently, he's pursuing a PhD in law. Most recently, Betts and Elizabeth Alexander, the Mellon Foundation president, announced their Million Book Project, an initiative that will establish libraries in 1,000 prisons across the United States. Betts is the architect of the initiative and our guest today. Welcome to Shades of Freedom, Dwayne. We're very pleased you could join us.
Oh, nah, man. It's a pleasure. Pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me.
So my first question to you is, as a bright 16-year-old with dreams of being an engineer, how did you end up involved in the criminal justice system?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I guess the simple answer is I carjacked somebody. And the more complicated answer and the more evolved answer, maybe, you know, my life project is thinking about what it is that exactly leads a 16-year-old doing relatively well in school to end up carjacking somebody. And as far as an answer, part of it, I think, is, you know, I was just sort of proximate to a lot of violence. And what was in the realm of possibility for me included even like included more so than anything else, going to prison, committing a crime. And that is not to say that, you know, coming up in a neighborhood with a fair amount of violence and crime, that meant I was destined to go to prison. You know, I ended up, even after doing 8 years in prison, I was still a first generation college student. Still a first-generation professional student. I just mean that it was within the realm of possibility. And sometimes when things are in the realm of possibility, it becomes easier to fall within that. And I kind of fell within it.
You've stated in previous interviews, and you've mentioned the book titled Black Poets and how it had a significant impact on you while in prison. How did reading that book during the space of time and experiencing it influence you?
Well, I was at a prison that didn't have a library, first of all. And then when you're in a hole, books become contraband. And so I'm in a prison without a library, in a space within that prison where a book is literally contraband. And we had developed a kind of underground network of communication where you just call for a book, or you tell the houseman, you tell the cat that's locked up with you, that's a custodial worker, hey, yo, find me a book. And while he's walking down the hallway, he'd be like, yo, who got a book? Who got a book? And so sometimes he would like sweep the book into your cell that somebody else would slide out. Or depending where that person was, they would like get on the ground and they would slide the book from their cell to yours. And you literally just may have no clue of who sent you the book. One day I asked for a book and somebody sent me Dudley Randall's The Black Poets. And you know, the thing is, again, man, it's what are you proximate to? So I had already told myself I would be a writer. And suddenly I get this book and I'm introduced to Sonia Sanchez, Lucille Clifton, Robert Hayton. And you know, the main poet that hit me from that book was Etheridge Knight. Because Etheridge Knight, you know, he served time in prison and he wrote about prison. And he was a person that was really trying to figure out what the experience of prison meant for the human condition. And seeing him able to do that and seeing him able to get published and seeing him able to be in a book with Gwendolyn Brooks, it just made me say, all right, I'm gonna be a poet. That's it. Decision made. Mm-hmm. And it's wild because I was young, didn't really know what being a poet meant. Didn't know what the salary was. You know what I mean? Like, you know, post incarceration in college, everything that somebody's telling you what to be is driven by how much money you'll make doing it, mm-hmm. by the kind of influence you'll have doing it. And I wanted to be a poet really because I liked how he made me feel and think about the world. And I was like, that's the thing I want to do. And I've just sort of been lucky to be able to turn that into a life, you know?
So you obviously had a love of literature before you went to prison. What are you thinking about with regard to all of those young people of color out there who might be would-be poets, would-be writers, whose access to quality educational material and literature is limited?
The disaster of it for me is twofold. First, something that's really depressing, even when I think about it, of knowing that I became so much of who I am, partly because I found a book in prison. I mean, it's just something profoundly tragic about that. And knowing that a lot of people who are in prison, because we lock up so many people, and we have so many people inside, most of those folks won't have access to Felon, which is the last book of poetry I published. They won't know who John Murillo is. And I think it's something sad about that, because again, we're talking about how do you set up a framework that suggests what's possible. That's what being introduced to Etheridge Knight through the Black Poets did for me. It gave me a different framework of what was possible. And that was the most important thing I could have got at that moment, given that I was a teenager in solitary confinement, headed to a super maximum security prison where we were going to be on lockdown 23 hours a day. You know, it was literally those words that kind of pushed me through. And so it's just something tragic about knowing that, one, I had to be in a place like that to discover it. And two, most people, even if they are in a place like that, have no hope of discovering it in today's America.
Mm. We speak of great poets. And one that comes to mind is, of course, our mutual friend, Elizabeth Alexander, who I had the great good fortune of working with while we were both at Ford. Can you tell us a story about how you two met?
It depends on what you mean by met, right? And it's the beautiful thing about poetry. The first book I got was that Black Poets book, mm-hmm. right? Then I go to this other penitentiary, Red Onion State Prison. And one of these cats that I got close to, and I don't even know why we got close. He had long locks. He gave me every shit I ain't sleep. He was like, I think you dig mm-hmm. this. I don't know why. He was like, you look like somebody who would dig this book. And that's the first time I read Elizabeth's work. You know, she had the Venus Hottentot poem mm-hmm. in there. I think the Ali poem is in there as well. And this was me learning that poetry is also history. Poetry is also philosophy. This is me now. I'm stretching out because the Black poet was, you know, this was a previous generation. This is sort of the Black arts movement and the post-Harlem Renaissance movement of poets. But this wasn't really the contemporary mm-hmm. poets. So then I get Every Shit I Ain't Sleep. And it's like, Yusef Kominyaka, what? You could do this with words? And so that was me meeting her the first time. But when I met her personally, and this is the thing, I wasn't in prison imagining meeting these people. Mm-hmm. But it's an organization called Cave Canem that was started by Toy Derricotte and Cornelius Eaton.
Yes.
And I came home and I was like, I'm going to get into this joint. And I came home. And I ended up getting in. And it's a organization that one of their flagship initiatives is a summer retreat just for Black poets. And it's 54 Black poets. Elizabeth Alexander was there. Rita Dove was there. Lucille Clifton was there. Patricia Smith was there. Kwame Dawes was there. And then Toy was there. And Cornelius was there. And you got to understand, man, I'm like, I ain't even been out the penitentiary for 15 months. And I'm walking around every day for a week with like, my heroes, you know, and like one morning, Lucille Clifton gives a talk, and the next day, and the next night, Rita Dove gives a talk, and I'm staying up to 4 o'clock talking to Rita Dove. Mm. I remember it was a party one night or something. Folks was dancing, and I'm like talking to, I was talking to Elizabeth, and what happened is, I asked her for something that she'd written about Black men, you know, and I was just But I was, you know, I was like young, I was 25, just talking, kind of awed, you know? And she gave me her book, like her book.
Wow. The one with the sticky notes
and the lines in it that she was carrying around reading from. Actually, I'm looking at my shelf. Her book is right there. It's so funny. You would think I was lying. You would think I was lying if I would grab it and show it. I'm gonna take a picture of it. But you would think I was lying to you. But her book is right on my shelf, beside Every Shed I Ain't Sleep.
Wow.
And it's The Black Interior. This is the kind of thing that doesn't exist in prison at all. But it's also the kind of thing that is a product of a kind of privilege that even most people in the world don't really have. You know, I'm come out of the penitentiary with some poems, and all of a sudden I'm around the two living Pulitzer Prize winners that's black, period. You know, I'm around Lucille Clifton. I'm around people who I first met in solitary confinement. And that was a humbling experience, but that's where we met, and we stayed in contact. You know, we stayed in touch ever since then.
That's such a powerful, powerful story. I know you're a lover of literature, so I'm going to quote or paraphrase a little bit of Shakespeare when he writes, "There is a tide in the affairs of humankind, which taken at the flood leads on to fortune. Omitted, all the voyage of their lives is bound in the shallows and in miseries, and we must take the current when it serves or lose our ventures." Can you explain what the Million Book Project is? How and why did you take the current when it served?
I'm thinking about my own book, and I'm thinking about Felon, and I'm thinking about how my book costs $26.95, $27, $28 plus tax, more than 120 hours of work when I was in prison working for 23 cents an hour. So what I'm thinking about is, how do I raise some money to be able to send this book into prison? Because, you know, we get obsessed. I get obsessed with whatever it means to be talented, whatever it means to be accepted, to be good, to be dope, to be whatever. And then I realized that I'm trying to be all of these things, and the people who I imagine writing for can't even read my words. My book is in hardback, which means it can't get into prison in some states, even if somebody had the money to buy it. So I'm pushing to get some funding to fund a freedom edition of Felon. And I get that. But I've been having a series of conversations with Melon. And again, it's somebody saying, "I see you. But what is this bigger thing that you're thinking about? What is this bigger thing that you might be able to do to have a different kind of impact on the world in which you're paying attention to?" I always thought, what would it mean to curate that suite of books, that collection of books, to curate a freedom library, which Elizabeth coined it, freedom libraries, after it got announced, but to build a freedom library, understanding that words are always the pathway to freedom. Mm. If you're here for 8 months, if you're here for a year, if you're here for 2 years, let me put something in your sight every day that gives you a sense of the possible, but also gives you a pathway to build a foundation to do the thing that you might want to do in the future. Because part of the thing that sustained me, though, through all of this, from my first job at Caribou Books to the conversations I had at Cave Canem, to my work as a student, was that I had read so much, I was able to join into a series of conversations. You know, even though my life experiences suggested that I should be in no way prepared to have those conversations. And that's what books did for me. And so the Million Book Project, you know, putting a million books in the prisons, putting them in the prisons 500 at a time in freedom libraries, is because the bookshelf I'm looking at right now has 500 books on it. And I walk past this every day, and my son see it every day. And I recognize that it's the communion with books that built me. And so I want to give others the opportunity to have a communion with books. I don't know if there's anything more tragic, you know, and nobody says this when we talk about mass incarceration. You could do 10, 15, 20 years in a prison cell and don't see flowers, don't see any trees, and literally never see more than 10 books at one time. You know, I can't fix the flowers. I can't fix the trees. I can't really bring children. But you think about it, you know, you could have books that have all of those things in it. You could have the children's books. And if somebody in prison that has a 7-year-old who has no clue what to read to that 7-year-old, because the prison libraries don't have children's books. In fact, they in prison and they don't even think about reading to their kid because nobody's having a conversation about it. Just putting a book on a bookshelf and having somebody be able to go and browse it makes them say, oh, what if I did this? What if I read this to my kid, you know, or wrote them about this, or saved up some money and bought this for them? So the idea really is to think about books as a passageway, an entryway, a conduit to becoming more than so much of what the system of incarceration tells you that you are.
You sort of alluded to this, but my question to you is, what are the major obstacles you have faced since starting the project, and has censorship been an issue?
Nah, censorship hasn't been an issue. I mean, a major obstacle is you got to pick 500, you know, and like the, we make an argument about how literature matters, but also which literature matters, you know, and like, it's not that just these things matter, but in this sense, this is the world I'm trying to build. And then in terms of just prison censorship, honestly, it exists, but I'm also putting one of these freedom libraries for the guards, because the reality is that this is just great work, and everybody will be uplifted and changed by it. And we want to, you know, create a prison-wide conversation, and not one that's just confined to just the housing units. And then finally, some books will be censored. I mean, some books, it's just like, my book has gotten censored before. And I got a chapter called How to Make a Knife in Prison. And the guard was like, well, you know, I thought she was talking about how to make a knife. And we had to go back and forth with him. And I was like, nah, that's not what it was about anyway. And I sent 12 copies into a friend of mine because he wanted to start a class. First chapter is about how 30 minutes could change your life. And so he wanted to encourage the guys around him to talk about how their lives have changed really with these things that they've done in 30 minutes. Mm-hmm. He wanted to use the book to have that conversation with young folks. And so what I was able to do when it came time to kind of combat the censorship is to let them know the context of the book, to let them know the context of that particular story, because they had only read four sentences of a, you know, 250, 300 page book. And then they pulled back. And so I think there will be instances where it feels like censorship and I get them to pull back. And it'll be other instances where they might not, you know?
Mm-hmm. I mean, you talked about that experience of actually meeting the author with Elizabeth. I love the fact that you said you met Elizabeth Alexander first through her writing, and then you had the opportunity to meet her face to face. How powerful both of those experiences were. Do you anticipate providing those same opportunities for authors of some of these books and the individuals who are reading them?
Yeah, so in two ways. And the first way is we are doing a show called Book Talk, and again, via Zoom. So if you wrote the book, I will give you 10 minutes to read from the story, and then we talk and we reduce the conversation to essentially a 20-30 minute interview, something that's real tight, and it doesn't replace you coming there live, but it teases it, right? So one is the book talk, but the other thing we'll do is we're creating ambassadors. So Randall Horton is one of the ambassadors, but Nicole Hannah-Jones is one of the ambassadors. When things ease up with COVID, we'll create opportunities for them to return to prisons in states where they live. And so it could be a juvenile detention center. It could be a prison, a men's prison. It could be a women's prison. Somebody like me, and so I'm like, yo, I'm going to the max. Put me wherever, you know, put me to place where people don't usually have resources. Other folks might be like, yeah, I don't like barbed wire. So do you have a medium, low security prison I could go to? But the point is, in a world in which COVID doesn't prevent a university from making sure that their students have access to authors and writers, it is no reason for us to pretend like COVID should prevent it from happening. And so the book talk is one way to keep it going. And then creating an ambassador program and knowing that we're going to have at least one ambassador for every state in the country and Puerto Rico will ensure that it'll be, you know, thousands of people who interact with authors who they imagine they would never meet. And we'll have a couple hundred authors too, who probably have never been in a prison. And they get a chance to go into prison and remember that, you know, prisons are part of the community as well. You know, it's not as if, you know, we going to see people on Mars or something.
Mm-hmm. That's such a great segue to my next question. And that question is, how do you imagine the Million Book Project engaging in partnership with communities in a way that members of communities would demand that these libraries are established in institutions of confinement?
There's a few ways to do that. One way is, you know, it's a local project and a national project. And so the local aspect of it is that you have a writer, you know, say whoever the writer is, but you have a writer and they might live in New York, but I want them to come visit a prison where they're from. I'm making myself sort of a model for this. I would have went to Michigan this week and I would have visited a juvenile detention center when I was there. And then I would have went into a prison while I was there. And then I would have went to the university and I would have did some public radio spots. And so that's the way that you kind of encourage one, the university to say, and some already do this. So I don't want to act like I'm originator of this idea, but some universities, when they have speaking engagement, they have people come through. They always ask them to go into the local jail because they got an inside out education program there. And so they treat the guys inside like their students because they are their students. So through doing this, though, that's how you get the push on the ground and say, yeah, these freedom libraries should exist. The one thing I'd be remiss if I didn't mention is we also going to do a run of, you know, classics. So we talking about Odyssey, you know, we talking about the Iliad, we talking about Life and Times of Frederick Douglass, we talking about Don Quixote. And what we're going to do is these books are all in the public domain, is reprint them, but reprint them with contemporary introductions.
Wow.
Because what does Great Expectations say about today? And the beauty of it, though, is that none of us are going to be asked to write about Moby Dick. Let's just be real. You know, like the people who are writing about Moby Dick or Great Expectations or Dracula, you know, the folks who get asked to write about that, they're like tenured English professors and they're writing scholarly texts on a work that nobody in the world is ever going to read, right? But it's like, wait a minute, I would love to hear, you know, I can't tell any names because I don't want to reveal my plans, but I would love to hear some contemporary writers talk about these works of the past. You know, what would they say about it? And then what happens, though, is that suite becomes a thing that's unique to the Freedom Library, and it becomes a reason that you want to have it, because you want to hear what this contemporary writer has said about this classic book that that otherwise they wouldn't have really been writing about. And then think about these five or six or seven books in concert and these contemporary writers writing about all of them. So it'd be kind of interesting.
You know, when I was a student at the Breadloaf School of English at Middlebury College, one of my favorite courses was titled The Impact of African Americans on Dead White Male Authors.
That's so funny. That is funny.
Yeah, it was actually, yeah, it was a great, it was a wonderful course because you actually got to see the how African-Americans shaped their thinking and their writing.
Well, what's interesting about that, though, one of the other things we're doing is creating a syllabus. It's like a creative writing syllabus, but it's a just like text that accompany the project. And this isn't central, but we already developed it. And the reason why we did it is because even putting in, you know, a million books is not really enough for everybody. I got a 500 book library. So ideally, everybody in prison would have their own 200, 300 book library. And that's not the scope of this project. But what would it mean to provide them with a syllabus and the works in the syllabus so that they could begin to think about what it means to read work in concert? And so, you know, we broke it out in 1 week. Each week you got nonfiction, fiction, and poetry. And all of the work is being drawn from the work in the Freedom Library. So that way you got this 10-week course, but the 10-week course gives you a sense of how to gauge with text across a period of time and a really like intense, concentrated period of time that forces you to read a lot of stuff at once that you typically wouldn't. And again, this is just a skill that you learn in college that you wouldn't necessarily get had you not been in college. But it's kind of nice to be able to add this as a component to thinking about the Freedom Library, to thinking about the books there. Because frankly, you know, it took a while for me to begin reading two or three books at a time and for me to start to think naturally on my own how this book influenced that book, influenced that book, influenced that book. And it was only through anthologies, actually, that I began to think that way. Because when you lay them out in chronological order, you could kind of see some of the influences, depending on how good the editor is, you could see some of the influences coming through and some of the themes coming through and some of the echoes. But that's just like really hard to get in prison. I never had a fiction anthology in prison. I never had a short story anthology in prison. And it's actually really great, though, to be able to connect with these folks and think about how to make their work available in ways that happenstance almost made it come to me. But how to do this in a way that's not happenstance, that's really intentional.
This has been such a great conversation, and I'm going to ask you a question that I will ask all the guests of this podcast, and that is, when you hear the phrase shades of freedom, what does that mean to you today and into the future?
So Etheridge Knight basically turned prison into the metaphor for which he kind of used to understand so much of the world. And in a lot of ways, I think prison has become what I use to understand so much of the world. And I sort of feel like what I have is a shade of freedom. You know, we talk about incarceration. And when I think about abolition, and when I think about criminal justice reform, and when I think about decarceration, what I'm constantly thinking about is the way in which we only have a shade of freedom because there are so many people that's still there. You know, and it's almost as if the prison population is the body. And a few of us that's free, you know, we create the shade. And it sort of just depends on how you look. And sometimes the shade is bigger than the body. Sometimes the body is bigger than the shade. But you always know that it's this other thing there. Maybe I'll carry that phrase around with me in my head because it allows me to remember that it's a thing that's still lacking. You know, it's a thing that we still trying to chase.
Thank you so much, Dwayne Betts, and good luck with the Million Book Project. It's so important, and good luck with the establishment of Freedom Libraries in prisons all across America. Thanks so much.
Thanks for joining us for Shades of Freedom, produced by the Aspen Institute's Criminal Justice Reform Initiative. We'll be back soon with more thought-provoking guests working to transform the criminal justice system. You can find out more about the Criminal Justice Reform Initiative, read our recent reports, view event videos, and join our email list at aspeninstitute.org/CJRI, or follow us on Twitter at AspenCJRI. CJRI's programs are made possible with support from the Ascendium Education Group, Arnold Ventures, the Bank of America Charitable Foundation, the Chan Zuckerberg Initiative, and Google.